For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in time of need.
Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1. We'll be coming to that first and back to Hebrews later as we did this morning. Began this morning looking at the words mercy and truth and looking at their relationship with each other, but even more so the frequency, especially in the Old Testament, in which they are mentioned primarily in connection to God. We noticed different translations shine a little different angle on the word, whether it's mercy and truth, steadfast love and faithfulness, love and faithfulness, loyal love and faithfulness, loving kindness and truth. So just some different shades of different meanings of these same concepts that originate with God. We looked in the Proverbs to show the way of wisdom is that these ought to be in us and practiced, as we read in Proverbs 3, to put these around your neck, do not let them depart from you. And the more we see that in God, then the more we appreciate that He has shared His mercy and His truth with us, then the more we ought to understand the value of those things being in us and using opportunities to share those with others. And so that's going to be the focus tonight. This morning, more of the principles, and tonight looking at examples of God's mercy and truth. And so turn to Genesis chapter 1. There was a time in life where I thought, well, I've learned about Genesis and the garden, and you know, I learned that in the children's classes growing up, and so now I need to move on to meatier things. And the longer that I live, I realize going back to the beginning that there's plenty of meat there, full of application. And so think about, though, the words mercy, truth, loving kindness, faithfulness. I don't think any of those words appear in Genesis chapter 1, but read with me verse 28 and see if you see in this verse this concept. God doing this. This is the sixth day, and so He's created man and woman, Adam and Eve. And it says, then God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So God creates Adam and Eve, and immediately every need that He created them with, There's everything that they need to provide for that. And so they're going to be hungry. And so He's provided them all that they need for that. There's that instinct in man and that need of man to work and to have a purpose and someone to work for. And so God gives them something to do, not busy work, just to occupy their time, but the kind of work that is good for their body and their soul. And then it isn't just Adam working for Adam. Is there not any benefit to you when you're working for someone else? It gives you an extra degree of motivation, whether it's your spouse and your family, helping the church in their work, someone else in your family. That's a part of what the book of Ecclesiastes is teaching when it says two are better than one. There's a benefit to work. And so God provided that for Adam and Eve. Not only companionship, but also divine companionship. God was meeting that need there in the garden, as He would come to the garden. And so here in the beginning, there's God's loving kindness in the way that He created this earth, His faithfulness to them, that there was a provision so that what they need would continue to be provided. All of that is here from the beginning, and it continues until today, doesn't it? In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus teaching us how to treat our enemy, He says, well, God sends the rain on the just and the unjust and allows His sun. Think about that. You look at pictures of the sun. Who does that sun belong to? Jesus says, the Father's. It's the Father's sun. And He allows that to shine on you and me when we've lived in injustice and in unjust kind of life. And He allows it to shine upon us when we serve Him and live by faith. We need to notice those things. We need to pay attention every single day to God's expressions of mercy and truth. If we don't, then will our children pay attention to the gifts and the blessings that God gives us every single day? If we overlook them, they'll overlook them. And if we overlook them, then we'll be like the nine lepers who were given a gift and then just walked away assuming that it belonged to them. Every single day, we need to pay attention to, no matter how simple they might seem to be or how routine they may be, we need to pay attention every day that we wake up to God's mercy and truth. Then go to chapter 3 as I read verses 15 through 19 and then drop down to verse 24. Again, as I read, you just pay attention and look for where is loving kindness and faithfulness, where is mercy and truth in God's dealing with Adam and Eve after their sin. He says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, but thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Verse 24, so he drove out the man. Now, at first glance, you might think, well, that's not really a text of mercy. That's God punishing them and kicking them out of the garden. But give it a little more thought. What does Adam and Eve's answer when God says, well, what have you done? Where are you? What does their answer say about how well they understand the problem of sin? Not very well. And so God's kindness and faithfulness to them is he's going to do the things that are necessary to help them see the kind of problem that they have involved themselves in, and then to provide a memorial so that you and I have, on a regular basis, reminders of the complication and the pain and the sorrow of sin. And so childbirth provides that reminder. Thorns and thistles, the work is not the curse, but work is harder than it had to be. And that's a reminder of the consequence of sin. And then God kicking them out of the garden. That wasn't pleasurable for God. That was his faithfulness. That's what, for one part, he had told them would happen. You will die. And that was his loving kindness. What could God have done? He could have done things much, much more harshly. But everything that he did was a response to their sin and a way to help them in mercy and truth. And then, of course, in verse 15, there's the allusion to Christ coming and crushing the head of Satan. We still today have the benefits of God's mercy and truth that he introduced here in the garden. Let's go over to the book of 1 Samuel. I think that Joshua and Nora and Joel's class have been passed from the judges into the time of the kings. And so let's look at something familiar. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 through 9. Again, as I read this, you have the people of Israel, you have Samuel, and then you have God obviously involved. Again, as I read, you think about where is their mercy or loving kindness here? Where is their truth and faithfulness? Who has it? Who doesn't have it? Who's showing it and who isn't? 1 Samuel 8, 4 through 9. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So for Israel's part, there's no kindness, there's no faithfulness. And God understands that this, he rightly interprets, this is an insult to God. God had been sending them judges. And we don't want judges anymore. It's kind of like what we read in Psalm 78. God sent them food, and well, we don't want that anymore. And so this is the same reaction from the same kind of people. And so there's no faithfulness in them. But on God's part, God could have responded in a variety of ways. God could have responded only in compassion and mercy and with no faithfulness and said, well, okay, I'll just kind of the bleeding heart, you know, parent, well, I'll just give them whatever they want. That'll solve the problem. Well, does God just unconditionally give them everything that they want? No. At times, you learn when to give them what they want and let them see how they like it. God did that often with Israel. And so that's what God is doing in this case, but not fully, not unconditionally. He says at the end, in verse 18, he tells Samuel, you tell them one day you're going to come crying for my help, and it will be too late. And so he does not respond with only mercy and compassion and, oh, just whatever you want. No, there's loving kindness here, and there's also faithfulness. He's giving them what they need and some of what they want. But God could have reacted also with truth and without any compassion to a wicked people. Again, as we read in Psalm 78, explaining God's patience there, that he could have wiped them off the face of the earth and started anew. He contemplated that at times and even talked to Moses about that. God had a right to do that. Or he could have just said, look, I'm your king. Don't say another word about that. He would have been fully in his right to do that. But God's response here is full of loving kindness and faithfulness to him. He had already proven his mercy in bringing them to the land and giving the land to them. And so God's character continues. How easy is it to see the mercy and the truth of God in sending Jesus to this earth? That's called an eternal purpose in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 11. And so, of course, Jesus' birth on this earth was no accident. It was a part of a plan that existed before the planet existed. But then when Jesus was born, it demonstrated God's faithfulness. Because while this plan had been made in eternity, in the book of Micah, God revealed to man in terms even more specific than what we see in Genesis chapter 3 about crushing the head of Satan. Well, what's that talking about? You compare that prophecy with the likes of Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. But you, Bethlehem, Ephratah, though you're little among the thousands, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. That's a lot more specific, isn't it? And so that's what God said he would do. Was God faithful to his word? He was when Jesus was born, exactly where God said that he would be. Go back to Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. So what was it like? There's not... All I can really do is ask the question. I don't know much of how to answer it. What was it like that day, or what? I don't know if you use the word day in regards to heaven, where there's not even really time, but for eternity there had been the Father and the Son and the Spirit in heaven. When Jesus comes to earth, what's it like in heaven when the Son isn't there? Have you ever thought about it from heaven's perspective? The Father showed mercy and truth in sending his Son. The Holy Spirit showed mercy and truth in his participation in the plan of Jesus coming to this earth. Then Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 and 16 reminds us of the mercy that Jesus came to provide for us in his life. Everything that he endured was for our benefit. If Jesus was only coming to earth just to provide the atonement, the life, the death for our iniquity and for our sins, did he have to live on earth for 33 or so years? Did he have to be nailed to a cross for 6 hours and hang there suspended in pain, having already been bleeding and tortured? Did it have to be that bad? Could it have just been a shorter suffering and a shorter life and then just go down to earth real quick, do what I have to do, the bare minimum, and then get back to heaven, because that's where anybody would want to be? Was not all of his time and every one of his trials, including his crucifixion, it seems that he went, as we might say, above and beyond. He did more than he had to. He experienced more things than he had to just to obtain the opportunity for us to have our sins forgiven. He went through separation and discouragement. And what we read from Hebrews 4 is that he did that so that we could know that he can sympathize with us. He knows what it's like to be tired and overworked and in demand. Everything, he's had that. And every form of temptation, he has to some degree. And so he provided everything for us in coming to this earth. The life of Christ could be summarized in a variety of ways. But as the Old Testament identifies God as one of mercy and truth, Jesus comes and puts that on full display. When we think about Jesus' second coming, and we think about the Day of Judgment, I don't know how often that comes across your mind. We sing songs and sometimes read passages that help to get our attention on the fact that this is reality. Heaven and hell are as real as COVID is real. In Matthew 25, Jesus paints this picture for us so that we can grasp a little bit better with some future event that we've never seen anything like before, and so it's hard to understand. But he boils it down here that there's going to be two outcomes at the time of Jesus' second coming. When the Son of Man comes, verse 31, then in verse 34, to some he's going to say, the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. In verse 41, to others, he's going to say, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. There's two outcomes at judgment. We live in a world where some people expect that's going to be a day of just all mercy, and so they become lax in how they view sin and how they think about their own guilt and consequences. I don't mean of sins we've been forgiven of, but I mean sometimes even Christians can become lax because, well, I'm a Christian, so I'm going to be on kind of a different sliding scale. The curve is going to be bigger for a Christian. Well, all we can do is judge sin by how God judges sin. Some people, on the other hand, expect God's only going to be faithful, and they think of his faithfulness only in terms of his condemnation. And so God has said he's going to punish the wicked. And so I've been wicked all my life, 40 years, 50 years, and so how is God really going to forgive me here towards the end of my life? Maybe my sin has had consequences on the lives of my children or of other people. And how could God be, would God really be merciful to me? And so they only think of God being faithful in his condemnation and not the other side of that. How will God judge all people in all circumstances? Well, we could say a lot. He'll judge in righteousness and goodness and with severity and justice and wisdom. All of that is true. But when we think about the Day of Judgment and you standing there, your family will be there, but they won't be beside you. You'll stand before him, and he will judge in mercy with kindness, but also with truth and faithfulness to everything that he has said. God, from the beginning to the end, shows himself to be a God of mercy and truth. So then, God rightly, as he has not us just told us about these words, but then he's set an example from Genesis to Revelation until the end of time. And daily before our eyes, he gives us examples of it. And the more that we meditate on the things that he has said and think about his reaction and his response to the way that men have lived before him, then God rightly expects not only that we understand he to be a God of mercy and truth, then God looks at you and looks at me and says, I expect you to be. You're made in my image. I expect you to be someone characterized by exactly the same words, mercy and truth. We read that this morning from Proverbs 3, verse 3. Do not forsake them. Do not let mercy and truth forsake you. Let it be around your neck. We read Proverbs 14 and verse 22, that mercy and truth is what comes from those who devise good, who plan good. And then James just echoes those same thoughts. And so what will our life look like if we are people of mercy and truth? First of all, think about how we can return. How do you return mercy and truth to God? In one sense, God doesn't need our mercy. There's no time in which we're merciful to God. But the way that Jesus described the judgment of that last day in Matthew 25 was, well, when you're merciful to the least of these, my brethren, when you see any need for mercy in them and you meet it, then you've been merciful to me. And those who were condemned were told, when you didn't pay enough attention to see that the least of my brethren, the least noticed among my people, when you didn't notice them, God says, I noticed that you didn't notice them. So we can return kindness to God. We do that by his people, by showing it to his people. In Joshua 24, verse 14, Joshua's farewell address, he urged the people to serve God in sincerity and truth. And that word truth is the same as this faithfulness. So serve God with faithfulness. Was that something that, a lesson that Israel had shown throughout their history? Again, Psalm 78, as we've been reading, it's a summary of Israel's history, and it's a summary of Israel's unfaithfulness. And Joshua had lived through much of what we have read so far in that psalm. And so he urges them, be a new generation, serve the Lord in sincerity and faithfulness or truth. And so that's what God is looking for from us, not only knowing the truth, but then faithfulness in the practice of that. And when we live before God with mercy and truth, we're not inventing some man-made scheme of religion. We're imitating the God who made us in his image. Turn to Romans chapter 12. God expects to see mercy and truth from you and me when we walk among the darkness that is in this world. And when that darkness comes face to face with us and their hypocrisy, their inconsistency, or their just outright wickedness and meanness and evilness. When we face that, Romans chapter 12, verses 17 and 18. Again, these words aren't in these verses, but these words are in these verses. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. You know, the more that we're around the people in the world, which we're supposed to be, how can we be a light in the darkness of this world if we're not around the darkness for them to see something that's different and for there to be a contrast? So when are they going to see a contrast in us? Well, in one sense, we can say, well, they always should. Well, that's true, but what's described in verses 17 and 18 is, people are going to pay us evil. And here is an opportunity for us to shine, to be the lights of the world. How does the world react when someone pays them evil? Well, they just give it right back and then maybe a double portion of it. And what Jesus is teaching us here is that's an opportunity. That's a time where you can earn the reputation of being different, that you show mercy and truth to someone who has already introduced themselves to you by not showing mercy or truth or faithfulness. Maybe they betray us in some way. That's the time where he says, you show mercy and truth. Let's keep reading verses 19 through 21. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. In other words, wait. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, verse 20 is mercy and truth, isn't it? If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now notice, this verse doesn't mean, well, you just cater to everyone's needs and you be a doormat and you just let them do whatever they want to do and you just take it and say, go in peace. He says, verse 18, if it is possible, then live at peace with all men. In other words, you can't control what they do, but for your part, your goal is peace. And how could we summarize trying to accomplish peace? We could say we have two tools in our box, mercy and truth. And if we work with those the best that we can in our relationships with people who are lost, and maybe they're nice people, but they don't have the foundation of God and of Jesus Christ, God's given us these tools so that if peace is going to be possible, here's what we can use. Peace will not always be possible, but when it isn't, God is going to judge, well, why didn't that work out? And let's be sure that others have made themselves our enemies and that we are not the ones continuing the disruption of peace by using mercy and truth. Think about that in our home. Our home needs to be a place of mercy and truth. We read this morning from Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 28. This is written in regards to a king, but I just mentioned this morning, when you read about a king in Proverbs, it's usually talking about some principle of leadership. And so he says, mercy or loving kindness and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness he upholds his throne. And when the king provides a stability by his leadership, then that's a benefit to the nation, isn't it? And so in the home, we just start with husbands and with fathers. You set the tone for mercy and truth. Fathers, our society maybe doesn't think about a macho man being full of loving kindness, but that's the kind of man that the picture that God paints. Husbands and fathers, in whom is seen loving kindness and faithfulness. That's how a true king sits on his throne in his castle. He builds his castle with the stones of faithfulness and loving kindness. Mercy is a challenge in our home because who are we with more than the people in our home? And so we're with them on our good days and our bad days. They see the best of us. They see the worst of us. And sometimes both of our worst overlaps at the same time on the same day. And what I do affects often what others do, and what they do affects me. So how do I respond to all that? Not always the right way. How do I change? What do I think of to help me react in the right way? How about mercy? Mercy in our home. And then faithfulness. Faithfulness is not just sexual purity. It's part of it. It's not just, well, I keep food on the table for my family and keep them clothed. That's part of it. It's not just sibling love among the sibling rivalry that's a part of the days of youth. But faithfulness includes the use of our time in our home. Faithfulness includes, I'm faithful with my words. And Starla and I's vows when we married, we used the language of 1 Corinthians 13, of what love is. And so whether that was in your vows or not, that was in your vows, wasn't it? To love your spouse, love your husband, to love your wife. And so our words are a part of faithfulness in our home. And even the reaction to our spouse, if they lack mercy, then we need to return mercy. They lack faithfulness in some way. Who else can they depend upon to show faithfulness than their husband or their wife? Think about in your home, in your life this week, that as God looks down, does he see a home of mercy and truth? And then last, the application is really very similar when we think about working together as Christians. Every church that truly is of Christ is one that is a church of mercy and truth. Think about the apostles, the 12 apostles. They weren't a local church in the same sense we are, but some of the same dynamics. You had a group of very different people among the 12, and we get some insights into some of the sparring that took place among them. There were some times where some of the apostles were at their worst, weren't they? Well, let us sit on your right hand and your left hand, Jesus. You ever wondered what kind of looks the other apostles gave? Sometimes there's some indication that there was a reaction to that. And yet, when the apostles were at their worst, Jesus was there, and the apostles learned loving kindness. Doesn't mean Jesus always patted them on the back and on their shoulder. Jesus was faithful to them and showed true loving kindness to them when they were at their worst. But despite the weaknesses that goes along with being humans and then working with other flawed humans like yourself, the disciples did that, and they were able to stay together. They didn't split and splinter and fall apart. Somehow the apostles were able to continue working together. No doubt Jesus was a big part of that when he was with them. But then after Jesus left, their cooperation still continued despite their differences at times and despite their failings. Peter is the one we know the most about. And so they learned how to overcome strife and disappointments and in their work together. Because of the mercy and truth of the gospel that they were learning. And so we ought to just expect in working closely in a commitment with other people, with other Christians, that's what the church is, we should expect some disappointments because we will disappoint other people. When we do, let mercy and loving kindness help us through that. Jesus is looking for that again as we looked at Matthew 25. When my people were hungry, provide for them. When they were thirsty, did you provide for them? I think we could add to some of the same kind of applications. When they were lonely, when they were discouraged, when they were weak, did you provide for them, in providing for them and providing for my church? Jesus would say, you are providing for me. There will be things that test our loving kindness and our faithfulness to each other. In some ways, that was this past year with all the illness and the mandates and some of the adjustments that we had to work through. That tested our willingness to think about others and what can we do to accommodate each other. I've mentioned before in Starl and I's recent trip back to the lower 48, there are still churches that are under some strict regulations, and there's conflict in some churches. And some members have even left this congregation and gone somewhere else because, well, the elders didn't handle the assembly the way that they thought that it ought to. This has put strain on the relationships of many Christians in our nation in this time. Well, what will it be next? This has been a test of mercy and truth among God's people. What else will test that? I don't know. But again, I know God has provided for us the tools of facing whatever can strain our relationships with each other. He's provided for us an example and the admonitions and urging us to be people of mercy and truth. So this is not the most important aspect of God. This is not all that you need to know about God. But I think especially by its repetition in the book of Psalms and elsewhere, this is a part of who God is, and repetition calls attention to that. It's not all you need to know, but if you don't think of God and respond to God in terms of mercy and truth, then you've got a flawed, partial view of God. And there's so much more that he has to offer if offered to man. And without mercy and truth in you, then not only are we missing out on the blessings that come with that, but we're separated from God without mercy and truth, without loving kindness and faithfulness in us. Think about those two words as we sing number 333. And if you're separated from God because of a lack of mercy, a lack of truth, or a lack of anything in the way of righteousness that God directs us in, if you're here not a Christian and you are ready to confess the faith that's in your heart and be baptized into Christ, or if as a Christian we can help you in your love being stirred up again to serve our God who is so good, if we can help you, he will give you rest if you'll bring your sin to him. If we can help you somehow, tell us how. Come as we stand and sing.